The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series.
Hello and welcome to the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series. I'm Daniel Norcross. In each episode, acclaimed writers, scientists and entrepreneurs reveal what inspires them. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by an historian, author and broadcaster who has written novels and non-fiction history books focusing on the Second World War, including The War in the West, A New History. He's also presented documentaries for both radio and television, including the BAFTA-nominated Battle of Britain, The Real Story, and the documentary Cold War, Hot Jets. He's a co-founder and co-chair of the annual Chalk Valley History Festival, the largest festival dedicated entirely to history in the UK, and he co-hosts the hugely popular We Have Ways of Making You Talk podcast with Al Murray. Welcome aboard, James Holland.
Nice to see you, Dan. How are you?
I am strangely well.
Despite it being relentlessly miserable outside and sullen leaden skies.
That's right. Well, as you know, I have attempted to turn the history of the Second World War into a metaphor for the 6 months that take place between October and March, which are the darkest and most miserable times of the Northern Hemisphere year. And you, on the other hand, have dedicated an entire life to the entire history, the six-year history of the Second World War. We will talk about that. We will talk about many things. But first of all, it's an Inspired Minds podcast. I ask this of every guest. Inspiration, is it important to you? If it is, where do you derive it from and how do you use it?
Yeah, it absolutely is. It's inspiration and excitement, I think, and passion. I think those three things sort of sit very comfortably together. You know, when I was a boy, it was watching Ian Botham or listening to the Beatles. But as I got older and then I started to interview veterans of the Second World War, it's very hard not to be inspired by someone who's been flying Spitfires in the Battle of Britain in 1940 and standing next to them and or sitting with them in a pub while they're picking up your pint and another pint and going, here's me and my Spit and there's this ME. And you know, it's just, it's absolutely fantastic. And it really does inspire. And it just makes you get more excited about the subject and more interested in the subject and trying to transpose yourself to that period and think, well, gosh, what would I have done had I been in that situation? And what they did and what they went through and what they achieved, I think is incredibly inspiring. And I think inspiration, and as I say, tinged with excitement, is very much kind of what drives me, I think. It really, really does. The inspiration to hit lots of sixes and excel as a cricketer, I still have the inspiration, I still have the excitement. I don't quite have the ability, sadly, which is very much my loss and disappointment in life. But yes, excitement and exhilaration and inspiration, I think those three things, they all come together. That's the stuff of life, isn't it? I mean, really.
It is the stuff of life. And what intrigues me about listening to what you've just said there is how much the people involved in your historical period of choice are the ones that are driving you on. You've been fortunate enough to meet some who are still alive, a dwindling band, but you get the opportunity to see them and that inspires you in turn to tell their stories. And one of the things that comes across in the histories that you write is that you are very person-centric. A lot of history doesn't really dwell on the individual because I suppose there's an awful lot of speculation. If you're going to talk about, you know, what happens in the 16th century, what is the character of a person, what they went through, kind of a slippery concept, kind of difficult to get your hands on. But you're able to make history out of still living artifacts.
Yes, but I think even if you're a classicist or a medievalist or whatever, I still think it's fundamentally our interest in history revolves around our interest in humankind that have come before us. You know, is the past a foreign country, like L.P. Hartley said, or are these people in the Tudor age? Are they someone that you and I could recognize if we had a pint with them in the pub? And I think it is human experience and all the vicissitudes that come with it. That is what drives our interest. Because I think fundamentally human beings are curious characters. And I think they're nosy as well. You know, why do people watch EastEnders or Coronation Street or any other soap opera? It's because it's gossip, really, isn't it? It's about being nosy in someone else's life. I kind of think history is just an extension of a soap opera, really. It's just, you know, I mean, biggest soap opera of all is Henry VIII and his six wives, etc. So, you know, the Second World War is, you know, what I prefer about that rather than classical times or medieval times is it's less that there's people still alive, although it's been, you know, I do consider it a massive privilege to have met all the people I've met. And I've met veterans from all over the world and both sides. That's not as if I'm just sitting there talking to ex-Tommies and so on. That it's sufficiently recent enough to have, A, an incredible relevance and tentacles which we're still feeling to this day, but also I think it's easier to imagine it. Maybe I'm just not as imaginative as others, but I think because it's so close, you know, when you're reading a diary of someone, let's just say who's in Normandy in 1944, for example, and it's a half-decent diary, trust me when I tell you that the past is absolutely not a foreign country at all. You know, L.P. Hartley on that, he might be looking back at kind of 1900 or something, but 1944, those guys that are writing, if it's a decent letter or it's a decent diary, they're absolutely the identifiable people. And it's really interesting what we tune into, and I guess also why a lot of humour works, is because it's the extreme parochialism on a kind of wide scale, isn't it? It's everyday things. It's everyday matters. I mean, it's why people listen to Taylor Swift, for goodness sake. It's because she talks about her everyday life. And young teenage girls who listen to it, or blokes for that matter, who listen to it sort of go, well, I can identify with that because I've been in the same situation. It's that familiarity that immediately makes you feel, okay, I'm seeing where this guy's coming from. And then you can empathize with their experience. And the moment you can empathize with their experience, you can start to understand a bit more of what they're going through. And that's the exciting thing about I think, particularly about talking to people from the Second World War and looking at those diaries and letters and so on. Because from that period, they are absolutely identifiable as people that you and I could completely relate to were you to meet their 31-year-old self or 22-year-old self or whatever. You know, they like the same things. They worry about the same things. It's just they find themselves ordinary people caught up in a truly extraordinary global conflict of which they are, for the most part, incredibly small pawns in this bigger picture. And how they deal with that is extraordinary. The resilience they show, for the most part. And yet, interwoven into those diaries are, you know, I was reading a diary of a guy who was a gunner and he was going, I've got a terrible cold. You know, if I was at home by now, I'd have my slippers on and be having a cup of hot milk. I mean, how can you not relate to that? And there he is in the kind of mud and mire of an Italian winter in, you know, November 1943. But immediately that little detail suddenly links you because you sort of go, yeah, okay, I might not go for the hot milk, but I might go for kind of cocoa or something. But it's the detail, isn't it, that suddenly seems familiar. And it's that familiarity in a totally unfamiliar setting, which is a war, horrific war in the middle of the Italian countryside. And so you can empathize with them and relate to them. And I think it's that relatability. You know, if you're relating to kind of Tudor people or Romans, for example, Romans are different people. You know, the past is a foreign country because their attitudes to life are completely different. They're not dictated by sort of Christian morals or anything like that. I mean, that, you know, they're just a totally, totally different world where free people live alongside slaves and it's just completely normal. You know, we don't live like that. So I think that's why I'm so particularly drawn to that period. And then it's impossible to have anything other than just total awe for what they did, what they went through, what they put up with. And it's not just the risk of life and limb. It's also the privations they suffered. I mean, just utterly miserable from having to sort of go out in the middle of the night and sort of do your business in a hole in the ground 50 yards from your tent when the rain's coming down, through to being shelled, through to kind of endless mud, through to lice in your uniform, through to just being cold, then hot, then, you know, broiled alive in Sicily, to freezing cold in a mountain in December in Italy. I mean, it's just incredible.
Do you feel that you have a duty in some sense to memorialize what they've done? And I ask that because my father fought in the Second World War out in Burma.
Goodness me.
And we have some of his diaries.
Wow.
They're pretty curt. Doesn't say a great deal. It's usually how far the ship's gone that day and whether or not he's been kamikazed that afternoon or not. And yet, growing up with him for years, he had no desire to talk about it. He didn't want to talk about the war at all.
Hmm.
And so you say that in reading these diaries, you can relate entirely to these people. I get that. I mean, my father was living in the house. He was somebody who went through these things. I could relate to him. But he didn't really want to discuss it. And yet, what you're doing, and I mean this in the very nicest possible way, but you are digging away at a trauma that affected tens of millions of people across the globe, all over Europe and way, way beyond. And when you're reading those diaries, you're reading those diaries and finding the innermost thoughts of people who perhaps weren't able to articulate it after the event. Do you feel that you've got a responsibility to do that to a degree?
I suppose so. I just find the whole thing just so enduringly fascinating because I'm still, you know, I've been doing this for 20 odd years of studying this period. And I keep sort of turning over new stones that I hadn't appreciated and thinking about things in a slightly different way. And new things sort of reveal themselves to me. It's very typical to come back from the war and you were a conscript soldier or whatever, even if you weren't a conscript soldier. You get demobbed in 1946 or 47 or whatever. And then you want to get, you know, everyone's in the same boat because literally every bloke you know has been in the war in some capacity. And you don't really want to talk about it because you've just spent 4 years in Burma or North Africa in the Mediterranean or whatever it might be. The last thing you want to do is talk about it. You just want to get on with a normal life. You want to, you know, find a girl, get married, have kids. And then the kids don't really want to hear about it because, you know, your reference point is in the war, you kids, you don't know how lucky you are listening to Mop Tops from Liverpool, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then they're a bit sort of fed up with it because it's just absolutely everyday part of the vernacular. The kids are fed up with it. You as a veteran don't want to talk about it. And because also you don't feel yourself special because, you know, everyone of your age is in the same boat. And then it's very often it's not until, you know, you've retired and grandkids are on the way and you've got a bit more time on your hands that you can sit down and actually reconcile what it is you went through and start thinking about it. And someone says, oh, you know, we're having a reunion for our ship. Do you want to come? And, you know, it's down in a pub in Southampton. And you sort of think, all right, yeah, that'd be quite interesting. And you catch up with friends. And suddenly you start kind of, you know, reading about it. And suddenly it's sort of a bit more to the forefront of your mind again. The other thing is also, is I think for a lot of people, they wanted to be known as the father or the grandfather. They don't want to be thought of as someone who's killing Japanese or killing Germans or whatever it might be. They don't want to be seen in that light. They don't want to be seen as someone who's had a period of his life which is extremely violent or distasteful. They just want to be an ordinary person. I mean, an awful lot of people have said to me over the years, I never really spoke to my father about it because, you know, he didn't want to talk about it. But they're quite happy to talk to someone like me because I'm completely neutral. And it's a bit like talking to a shrink. I remember talking to this German guy once. And, you know, he had this very traumatic story. And every time he got to a sort of particularly grim bit, he would just completely break down. And I'm not talking about a slightly wobbly bottom lip. I'm talking about convulsive sobs, head in hands, absolutely in pieces. Obviously, I kept saying, oh, you know, don't really got to tell me this stuff. And he kept going, no, I want to tell you. And at the end of this really very upsetting 2 or 3 hours I had with him, he said, I have never told anyone what I've just told you. And I thought, my goodness me, you know, all our guys, you know, patted on the back, they wear their berets and sort of march down Whitehall on 11th of November. And, you know, however traumatized they might be, at least they can be proud of it. Whereas this guy is traumatized. And he has to be ashamed of it. But actually, the difference between him and a British conscript is literally zero. It's just the side he's on. And I remember him saying to me some particularly awful moment where they'd been captured by Italian partisans and the partisans were trying to kill some Russians and making a really ham-fisted job of it. And these Russians were screaming and so on. And he said, that was the 30th of April, 1945. It was the day Hitler shot himself and it was also my 19th birthday.
Good grief.
Oh, my goodness, mate.
And that is a very important part of it for you, isn't it? The age of these people. Because so much of history is the history of, you know, to coin a rather irksome phrase, old white men. So much of the time we look at kings and queens and big, established, often middle-aged and elderly people and the power that they wield. Whereas the history that you're focusing in on is very much the history of the ordinary person.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I mean, people approach history in different ways, but for me, it's always been, I'm absolutely fascinated by the whys and wherefores and the nitty gritty. And as I've got older, I've definitely got geekier on statistics and chipping numbers and all that kind of stuff. But absolutely human drama is the root of it all, the root of the fascination. And there's different ways of doing narrative history if you're writing a book or even telling the story on a television documentary. There's, you know, or even talking about it on a podcast. There's different ways of doing it. But my way, particularly in my books, is rather than having a single quote from someone who you never then hear from ever again. I like to have a very, very defined cast list of characters that I follow, because I think then it's easier to empathize with them, because you get to know them, you get to know their foibles. And, you know, some of them are irritable and some of them are really jolly, and they're just different characters. And that makes it more interesting. And what I tend to do is I go from sort of bottom to the very top. So, you know, you do have Harold Macmillan and Churchill and Field Marshal Alexander, but you also have PFC Schultz and, you know, Gefreiter Heilman or whoever it might be. And the point about that is you can then really get involved with these guys' lives and the decisions they make. I mean, everyone's experiences are different, but they're also quite similar. You know, an infantryman climbing up Monte Cassino is, you could put 10 in a row and they'd all tell you a similar thing. It was awful. The mortars were coming down. Jerry machine guns were firing. There was nowhere. There was no cover. I was exhausted. It was dark. It was cold. Variations on a theme. It'll all be that kind of stuff. But if you actually know the character and decisions they make, I just think it makes it a much more interesting read. And it's more interesting for me. And I sort of think if it's more interesting for me, then it's probably going to be more interesting for the person that's reading it. I know. It's also the other thing is it's also the difference you see between someone who is 32 and married to someone who is 21 or 19 or 20 is just so huge, as it is today. Because there is a moment in your mid-20s where you cast away your childish things and you become a man and you get married and or buy a house or whatever. But suddenly you have a sort of level of your interest broaden because your horizons are just a little bit wider as you get older, inevitably, because of jobs, because of owning a house, because of being married, having kids, whatever it might be. Whereas when you're 20, 21, you're still pretty feckless. I mean, I know I was when I was that age. And what is fascinating, again, about reading diaries and letters is those differences betray themselves in those letters. So you might be 19 or 20 and old enough to command a 5 Sherman tanks or a battery of 25 pounders or 36 men and an infantry platoon. But you're still a boy man. You've left home, you're responsible enough to do that, you can vote, you can technically get married, all those sort of things, but you're still kind of, you know, dear mummy, please can you send that woolly jumper that I like so much because it's cold out here in Italy or whatever it might be. And you realize they're transitioning. They're going from kind of boyhood to manhood and they haven't quite let go, but they're old enough to be able to be in this perilous situation in the Second World War where they're actually given sort of ludicrous amounts of responsibility. I mean, Guy Gibbs is 24 when he leads the Dams raid. I mean, I know Ian Botham was considered very young when he was made England captain, but he wasn't having to lead the Dams raid, for goodness sake. I mean, there is a massive, massive difference. And what is absolutely amazing about that is these people are that age, but they have to be above that age in what they're doing in the war. But the moment the war stops for them, they're in a dugout writing a letter or in the mess in a tent writing a letter or whatever, they revert to being that young person. And so suddenly when you're reading all this, you can absolutely relate to them because you can remember what you were like at that age. I mean, recently, I mean, my son is now Ned, who you've met, is 22. But at the time I was writing about a particular tank regiment, he was 19. And I remember going to the Reichswald Cemetery, Commonwealth War Graves Cemetery, just on the western edge of Germany, just sort of probably about 10 miles from Nijmegen, very close to Cleve, the town of Cleve. And there is Lieutenant Rees, age 19, killed in his first action, arrived on one day, dead by nightfall the following day. How can you not be moved by that? How can you not be inspired by that? It brings it home because you realize that these people, it might be 80 years ago, but they're not very different from you or I.
I have to ask, though, the Second World War, we were brought up in it, people of a certain generation, our generation, brought up in it with war films. It was part of the culture, obviously, because so many people were still alive who had fought in it, and it shaped the entire geopolitical system that we grew up in. But it's a narrow focus of 6 years. You have a brother who's also an historian. And I'm rather tickled by the fact that your brother's area of specialism, Tom Holland, this is, could be seen to be roughly 2,500 years. Or in fact, if you want to include the dinosaurs, 250 million years. And yours is 6. What's going on here? Is this about rivalry? Is this about, take me into the Holland family home that creates two historians. So in that sense, you are very similar, but your approach to history, or at least the things that inspire you to write and to dig into the weeds, are completely different.
They are. I mean, when we were growing up, history was very sort of ever present, and we never did foreign holidays, couldn't do any of that kind of stuff. I mean, my father took a very dim view of anything that involved spices or different language. So we stuck very rigidly to Northumberland, North Wales and Cornwall. But of course, all those places are kind of, you know, full of interesting ancient walls and castles. So we spent an awful lot of time doing that. And my brother and I, you know, we loved Asterix and we loved history books with pictures and those Ladybird books about Henry V and Oliver Cromwell and Nelson. So we very much sort of grew up with that. And I think because Tom's my older brother and you know, he was always voraciously clever. You know, I found that all kind of very inspiring and we had a lot of mutual interests as well. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that I wouldn't be a historian and I wouldn't even be writing books had it not been for Tom. I've always said he and Michael Wood are my two greatest inspirations. I was obsessed with Michael Wood's documentary series when I was younger, and we religiously watched In Search of the Dark Ages and In Search of the Trojan War and all that kind of stuff. And Tom was, you know, I just remember being sort of, you know, enormously proud of him when he first started writing and wrote his first book and novels and stuff. And then he sort of branched out and wrote Rubicon. And he's always been my kind of inspiration, really. So if we talk about inspiration, I mean, he's been an inspiration because I kind of sort of thought, well, if he can do it, you know, there is a way forward. And I think one of the things about writing books is that it's such a big thing. I mean, I don't know about you, Dan, but I mean, I remember till I'd written my first book, the longest bit of prose I'd written had been my English language O-level. You know, it's just about 2.5 sides of A4. And, you know, that was it. So it's a big undertaking doing a book, but I had my brother, and then I was also, at the time when I was first writing, I started in fiction rather than nonfiction. I was working for Penguin Books in the PR department, funny enough. In fact, actually, I did the PR for Viv, which was amazing, in the year 2000, just as I was on the cusp of breaking free and being my own man as a writer and historian. But it sort of demystifies it for you because you're seeing how books work and you're seeing how people put them together and you suddenly think, well, you know, it's a big thing, but maybe it's not quite such a big thing after all. It is actually quite a big thing, but it enabled me to kind of take the leap of faith, get up every morning and write that first novel and so on. I suppose the other big kind of sort of Damascene moment for me was seeing a Spitfire for the first time or being aware of a Spitfire for the first time. And I promise you this is true. I was playing cricket at the time and I was at the non-striker and this amazing machine was sort of with this incredible roar, which where the kind of the tones of the engine sort of kept changing as it moved around the sky in a kind of incredibly compelling way, was pirouetting balletically kind of somewhere beyond mid-wicket. And I remember turning to the umpire while I was at the non-striker going, "What is that?" And he went, "That's a Spitfire," in kind of reverential tones. And I just thought, wow, that is literally amazing. And I've always had this slightly obsessive character. When I get the bug on something, I really get it bad. And it just so happened that the following weekend was Flying Legends air show at Duxford. Rachel, my wife, had absolutely no interest in going to Flying Legends at Duxford at all. So let me go on my own, which was literally the best thing she could have possibly done because it meant I could geek out entirely on my own without anyone cramping my style and looking at their watch and tutting and sort of going, "Can we go now?" So I could just completely indulge my absolute new passion. And, you know, that was it. Then to be sat in a pub with Jeff Wellham or Alan Wright or Pete Brothers and hearing them talk about flying Hurricanes and Spitfires in the Battle of Britain, these machines that I'd seen first over the cricket field and then at Duxford, just seemed completely, utterly amazing.
Did you get little toy soldiers when you were younger? Did you do Airfix kits?
Yes, I did. I did all that. I definitely had a Second World War phase when I was a boy. And I, you know, I read Commando comics and Airfix models and all that kind of stuff. Then it just completely went in my teens where sort of cricket and girls took over. But then came back to me and I suddenly just thought, what have I been missing?
I've got to ask, though, because it's not exactly the elephant in the room, but got fascinated by the First World War. Are you considering branching out into the First World War for the next 15, 20 years? Because you devoted quite a long time to the Second World War. And
yeah,
a lot of these themes are very similar. The themes of 18-year-old boys, 19-year-old boys in unbearably hellish situations way earlier than they should ever be expected to have to deal with them. Is that an area that you are drawn to at all?
Well, yes, because my maternal grandfather was in it. And actually, we all did a kind of family tour with a great friend of mine called Peter Caddick Adams. He's a brilliant historian himself. And he, God, that sounds like I'm saying I'm a brilliant historian. No, what I meant was he is a brilliant historian. You know what I mean. And Peter took us over because he's as good on the First World War as he is on the Second. And that was absolutely fascinating. And I am very interested in the First World War. And funny enough, there's a great sort of chronicler of particularly the British experience of the First World War is Lynn MacDonald, who did all these interviews with veterans in the 70s and 80s before it's too late and collected a huge archive of letters and diaries and whatnot. Anyway, she's sadly no longer with us, but before she died, she gave me her entire 1918 archive. So I've got that. I've got 130 plus interviews that she did with veterans of 1918 that have never seen the light of day. And I sort of feel there's a responsibility to do something about it at some point. But I still have unfinished business for the Second World War. I mean, you were mentioning that your father was in Burma. You know, I've only done one book on the Far East, and it was a very sort of short, narrow area. And there's at least two more books on that I'd like to do. There's a whole subject on the Atlantic War I haven't done that I'd like to do. So I kind of feel there's stuff to do.
Are you a completionist then? Were you a sort of a collector that used to make sure that you collected everything? Because what I'm hearing is, the difference, there are many differences between you and Tom, obviously, but Tom's podcast, The Rest is History, can be about the French Revolution one minute. It can be about William IV's coronation the next minute. It can be about Cleopatra and the Ptolemies. And he's prepared to move on. Listening to you, you just said, I've got unfinished business with the Far East. Now, where does it end?
I don't know. I'm going to keep going on this subject until I'm fed up with it and I've got nothing left to say. But right now I feel I've got quite a lot to say because my position on it is moving all the time because it's such a vast subject. It might be a narrow time frame in terms of years, but in terms of scope, people involved, nuances, all the rest of it, it's absolutely vast. And it just is a vaster subject in many ways than, say, the Romans who spanned a millennia. Yeah, I'm just going to, until the stuff that I feel I haven't got anything left to say, then I'm going to keep doing it. But it's interesting because I am constantly evolving my view. And one of the interesting things about doing the podcast I do with Al Murray is that has opened my eyes to a much wider world. Because before that, you're just scraping the tip of the iceberg when you're doing a TV program. And when you're doing a book, you're just doing that book and you're kind of reading around the subject. But to do a podcast where you 700 episodes, which we've amassed so far, you're covering a hell of a lot of ground. And your broader understanding of what's going on really does inform the micro. The macro informs the micro in very, very interesting ways. And although my kind of overall thesis on the war hasn't fundamentally changed in the last 12 to 15 years, there's so much nuance on this subject that it has done a bit. And that's why I still feel there's kind of interesting things to say and interesting things to do.
I wanted to ask you about your collaboration with Al Murray because it's intriguing to me. When you're writing a book, it's quite a solitary experience. You have to go in search of stuff yourself. You may use people as sounding boards, but ultimately you're sat there with your keyboard and it's you against that blank sheet. When you're with Al, and indeed Tom has Dominic Sandbrook as his co-podcasting host, is it a different process for you?
Yeah, I think it is just the reason why this came about in the first place was because Al and I used to meet up not infrequently because we had a shared interest in the subject matter. I've always found it incredibly useful to articulate thoughts about how you're viewing something because with someone who's well informed, because they can then offer perspectives. You can say, well, I've been thinking about this. And he goes, well, yeah, but what about that? And it sort of goes, yeah. And it takes you down another little sort of rabbit hole. It's very companionable. You know, and you're right, you know, writing is solitary, but isn't it exciting when someone else shares the same passion as you? The rest of my family just aren't terribly interested in the Second World War, and that's absolutely fine. And I've reconciled myself to that, and it's all right. But it's lovely to be able to talk to Al about it and for us to be able to kind of feel uninhibited about what we're saying. We can talk to each other. And, you know, what we talk about in the podcast is what we would be talking about were we in a pub over a pint of Camden Hells. I find it companionable. I find it fun and interesting, but I also find it incredibly useful because his knowledge is really very broad. I mean, you know, he is like my brother in that he just hoovers up books Tom, it's like watching him, you know, he picks up a book and it's almost like you can see him bringing it towards him and it just sort of disappearing into his head and coming out the other side, just the kind of the covers. Al has that same capacity. You know, Al is a very, very clever person. You know, he's an Oxford history graduate, incredibly sharp. And he has that same capacity for learning and reading and just absorbing a huge amount of material. But it's not just about absorbing material, because the more you know, the more you can textualize what it is that you've been reading and fit that into a bigger picture. You know, he said something to me the other day, which has sent me off on a complete different train of thought that I hadn't thought about before, which is really interesting. You know, I've been thinking about it nonstop ever since, pretty much, because I'm just starting a new book at the moment. And I think I'm going to sort of bring a bit more of that. And it's that parochialism that we were talking about earlier on. The fact that detail gives you familiarity. And he was saying that that's the basis of comedy. You know, that's why comedy is funny, is because it's everyday. It's because we've experienced it, whatever it might be, that everyday situation. That's the basis of a sitcom. It's those little details, which quite often I was sort of thinking, well, I'll leave those out because maybe they're a bit boring. You suddenly realize, no, they're not boring. They're absolutely the stuff that brings this alive, those little details. And so I'm going to try and do a bit more of that in this new book. And that's all come about from a conversation with Al.
Do you think actually that the popularity of history at the moment, and it is enormously popular, the podcasts that you make and Tom makes, and I suppose popularizing history more generally, do you think it's even more important at a time now when so much can be faked? And I don't want to get entirely into artificial intelligence, because that's going to take us down yet another rabbit hole. But at the moment, you know, fake news is promulgated on the internet, people believing things that just aren't true, conspiracy theories exploding left, right and center. And I'm sure there have been conspiracy theories time immemorial. Nero fiddled while Rome burned. Well, almost certainly did not. So, you know, we've had conspiracy theories forever, but they seem to be more corrosive now than ever before, because they seem to be attached to people who are attempting to get power and attempting to get power off the back of things that aren't true.
Well, as it happens, I do think it has been ever thus. I mean, I really do. And I also think that, you know, fake news and my own personal truth and all this kind of stuff. I mean, talk about Russia and kind of its own view of the Great Patriotic War, as it calls its part in the Second World War. I mean, that's always been suffused with mythology. The Battle of Britain, for goodness sake. I mean, that's also suffused with mythology. So I don't think there's anything particularly new. I do think it's a little bit more sinister now, because you just have more means of relaying something. But I do also think it's incredibly important that young folk, school children, do study history. I mean, if it was left to me, I would 100% make it compulsory to do GCSE. At the very least, if not A-level. I mean, yeah, who needs maths? Goodness sake. I mean, you know, let's have history.
Or the history of maths instead.
The history of maths, maybe, yeah. You know, what key part of what we do with the History Festival is our festival for schools. And, you know, it has to be said that Rathbones are the key sponsor of that going into 2024. They are one of the key sponsors of the entire festival, and their particular area of sponsorship is the Festival for Schools. And they understand it's important, and it is important. I think it's incredibly important. You know, and you want to inspire people. It goes back to inspiration again. You know, what we're trying to do with, you know, it's very easy at GCSE where you've got to hit fence posts. You've got to learn by rote, because the people that are marking it might have nothing to do with history whatsoever. All they want to know is that you've hit the right Florence Nightingale button at the right moment. They're not interested in your view on anything. You've just got to hit what you've got to hit. And that is decidedly uninspiring. So how do you get people to be inspired by history? Well, you get people who are passionate about it, and you get people to bring it alive by moving away from the dull fence posts and bringing it back to the human experience of the past and human drama. And that's what we're trying to do at the festival, is try and inspire a cohort of young children. And the plan, the kind of, you know, the ambitious plans is to create a kind of a history hub, an online history hub. Because obviously we've got an amazing address book of all the best historians around, really, and certainly in the United Kingdom and indeed beyond. Have video content and various content with teacher notes and pupil notes that is free to absolutely everyone who wants to use it. I mean, what an amazing aspiration. I mean, the whole festival runs as a charity, so that is our sort of charitable aims. And it is absolutely about inspiring people and exciting people about the past and the incredible drama and rich story of our own nation, but of the world. That is absolutely the point.
Now, lastly, you alluded earlier to how history doesn't repeat itself, but we can learn things from it. And you wrote an intriguing piece recently about the Battle of Britain and Britain, as you've been very keen to remind people, we're always going to win that battle, partly because the Germans were much worse than people make out, and the British were an awful lot better. But you allude to the three M's in your piece, which you suggest are three M's that were massively missing from the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Do you want to elucidate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so this is a theory that I just came up with. The British Army still has these three levels of war, which I think are the moral, the physical, and I can't remember what the other one is. How do you judge warfare, and how are wars fought? You know, people are always wanting to sort of pigeonhole things. And it occurred to me that you could look at the three M's, which are method, motivation, and morale. And the interesting thing is, in the telling of history, we very often miss out the method bit. And the method is what we would call more technically the operational level of war. And this is nuts and bolts. It's the whys and wherefores. It's factories. It's money. It's shipping. It's resources, fuel, all that kind of stuff. But it's also what enables you to have your grand strategy and then put it into a kind of tactical frame, i.e., you know, it's what binds the whole thing together. So your method is how you fight your war. If your method is good, then your motivation will be clear, because you've made sure that you've got a very clear sense of purpose, that you've got your ducks in a row, that you know what you're going to do. And if your motivation is good, then your morale will inevitably be pretty high as well. And you need to see these three M's as a kind of sort of Venn diagram, a sort of meeting in the middle rather than a kind of circle. It's pretty foolproof, this. And certainly when you're looking at the Russian invasion of February last year, 2022, you can see the method was absolutely hopeless. They were attacking on a very broad front. Their logistical supplies were absolutely hopeless. The supplies to the front were absolutely hopeless. I mean, literally, the moment that that long column going down the road to Kyiv was stopped for more than 36 hours, I could tell that that was never going to get going ever again. It just wasn't. So that method was absolutely dreadful. Motivation, well, the people who were on the ground didn't have a clue what they were doing. They thought they were on a training exercise. The next thing they know, they were actually invading Ukraine. So motivation is poor. Why are we doing it? Don't really know. That hasn't been made clear to us. Consequently, they have a massive dip in morale. It goes horribly pear-shaped. Before they know where they are, they're being pushed back again. So these things are really important. You can certainly apply that to the Battle of Britain. You know, the method of the Germans, the Luftwaffe were not trained or designed to operate in isolation without ground troops and other supplies and all the rest of it. They weren't ready for the job. It wasn't clear what they were supposed to do. They only destroyed one out of 138 RAF airfields for more than 48 hours in the entire summer. Well, the whole point was originally they were told was to kind of destroy the airfields, destroy the RAF on the ground. They didn't do that. They had no understanding of how the British had developed the world's first coordinated air defense system. Their tactics were poor. Consequently, their motivation was confused and morale took a massive plummet and they lost. The only difference is that here we are kind of nearly 2 years on from the initial invasion. The war is still going strong, and Ukrainians, which have a nation which is, you know, a quarter of the size of the Soviet Union in terms of manpower and indeed of resources, is dependent on other people around the world who are now getting bored of it and are getting weary of it. Whereas Russia is now on a total war footing, is absolutely treating its men like cannon fodder, but Putin seems to be absolutely prepared to take gargantuan numbers of battlefield losses and spend 30% of GDP on defense. I mean, to put that in some perspective, next year it looks like it's going to be 40%. You know, we're struggling to do 2% at the moment in the UK, and it's not being very well spent either. You know, they proudly announced last week, the MOD, that, you know, in 3 years' time, we were going to have 100 Challenger 3 tanks. Well, Russian factories are currently churning out 100 tanks a month.
It seems like an unequal struggle.
I think all of that is quite worrying, and therefore my three M's is looking a bit shaky.
Well, it may look shaky for that particular theatre of war, but in part your article was suggesting that you could apply that to a whole load of seemingly unanalogous situations. But for example, in business.
Yeah, I think you can. People need to know what they're doing, why they're doing it, and they need to know that they're properly supported to do what they need to do. And then you will find an inspired, an invigorated workforce who are very happy about what they're doing. you know, it's interesting on just a level such as the History Festival. Suddenly everyone's got this very clear sense of purpose. They know what the method is. They know what they've got to do. We know what we're trying to, our end goal is for 2024 and beyond. And consequently, everyone in the team is really pumped. And it's really clear to see in a way that it wasn't before, because everyone was getting a bit down on it all. And so there is this sort of change around. And so I think you can apply the three M's. I think, and you know, obviously it's a conceit, which is natty because it's three words all beginning with the same letter. And that's all very neat. But I think the principles are, I think generally speaking, they do hold true. I've tried it out with quite a few sort of ex-generals and military types and people who know what they're about, and defense analysts, and no one's caught me out yet.
Well, do you know what, James? I might try out the three M's with our producer on this podcast, because it strikes me as a mantra that can work in almost any situation.
Well, it certainly could for England's fortunes in the recent World Cup.
Don't get me started on that.
Yeah, but you could apply it. You can absolutely apply it. Method poor, motivation didn't really know, you know, a bit half-hearted, morale plummeted, they lost. End of.
It's entirely applicable to a whole bunch of sporting situations, as it is, I dare say, to business as well. James, it's been an absolute delight talking to you in the dark gloom of an English winter.
Dan, thank you. It's been a huge pleasure. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the latest episode of the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series with me, Daniel Norcross, and my fabulous guest, James Holland. You can listen to previous episodes of the series on all major podcast platforms. And if you enjoyed listening, don't forget to like or subscribe. To find out more about the series, just go to rathbones.com.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series, now available on all podcast platforms and at rathbones.com.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series is brought to you by Rathbones, a leading provider of individual wealth management and asset management services to private clients, charities, trustees, and professional partners.
Please note, the value of your investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and you could get back less than you invested.